Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Straight Up. This is the subscriber version, and this is on the piece titled The Choice Facing Us, Greatness or Oblivion. And this was posted on Friday, July 12th, 2019. Subtitle here is Either Option is Still Within Our Grasp. Will we pursue the right one? As you know, in part one, it was about free will. And I was talking there about the ways in which we have these unconscious drivers. And those unconscious drivers could be psychological, that is from our past, the nurture portion of our childhood, or they could come from nature, programmed in, and exploring the idea, do we really have free will? Really interesting topic to me these days. So this part here, part two, begins, look, I don't need to pull any punches here among Peak Prosperity's paid subscribers, as you all know this well. Humans are at a very dangerous juncture of history. We might decide to be smart and create a brilliant future for ourselves, but the current odds favor our species defaulting into oblivion. And the Earth won't care. It's got an entire museum warehouse filled with failed species, all for one reason or another. Evolution is busy solving the most complex of problems, and failure is one of its most commonly employed tools. Michael Crichton put it very well in Jurassic Park when he wrote, quote, "You think man can destroy the planet? What intoxicating vanity. Let me tell you about our planet. Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There's been life on it for nearly that long, 3.8 billion years. Bacteria first, later the first multicellular life, then the first complex creatures in the sea and on the land. Then, finally, the great sweeping ages of animals, the amphibians, the dinosaurs, at last the mammals, each one enduring millions on millions of years, great dynasties of creatures rising, flourishing, dying away. All this against a background of continuous and violent upheaval. Mountain ranges thrust up, eroded away, cometary impacts, volcano eruptions, oceans rising and falling, whole continents moving, an endless, constant, violent change. Colliding, buckling to make mountains over millions of years. The Earth has survived everything in its time. It will certainly survive us. If all the nuclear weapons in the world went off at once, and all the plants, all the animals died, and the Earth was sizzling hot for 100,000 years, life would survive somewhere, under the soil, frozen in Arctic ice. Sooner or later, when the planet was no longer inhospitable, life would spread again. The evolutionary process would begin again. It might take a few billion years for life to regain its present variety. Of course, it would be very different from what it is now, but the Earth would survive our folly. Only we would not. If the ozone layer gets thinner, ultraviolet radiation sears the Earth, so what? Ultraviolet radiation is good for life. It's powerful energy. It promotes mutation, change. Many forms of life will thrive with more UV radiation. Others will die out. Do you think this is the first time that's happened? Think about oxygen. Necessary for life now, but oxygen is actually a metabolic poison, a corrosive gas like fluorine. When oxygen was first produced, it was a waste product. As a waste product by certain plant cells, some 3 billion years ago, it created a crisis for all other life on the Earth. Those plants were polluting the environment, exhaling a lethal gas. Earth eventually had an atmosphere incompatible with life. Nevertheless, life on Earth took care of itself. In the thinking of the human being, 100 years is a long time. 100 years ago, we didn't have cars, airplanes, computers, or vaccines. It was a whole different world. But to the Earth, 100 years is nothing. 1 million years is nothing. This planet lives and breathes on a much vaster scale. We can't imagine its slow and powerful rhythms, and we haven't got the humility to try. We've been residents here for the blink of an eye. If we're gone tomorrow, the Earth will not miss us. End quote. Hey, I think that really captures really perfectly this whole idea that the Earth is going to be just fine. But even if the Earth won't miss us, listen, as a human myself with the capacity to operate consciously, I happen to care a lot about the human experiment and that it carries on. I trust you do as well. In the Earth, in the end, the Earth will be fine. I'm certain of that. Humans? Maybe not so much. Biology as destiny. Our species is presently an overshoot in consuming fossil fuels and the resource equivalent of several planets to sustain our economy and our way of life. Plants, insects, and animals are all disappearing at too fast rates. We're literally eating fossil fuels without any sort of a plan B. And we know all this. And yet, we carry on as if it were not true. We claim to love our children and grandchildren deeply, yet we can't seem to rally to their cause. Why can't we plan for anything more than a few days or weeks ahead, let alone 50 or 100 years out? The answer is that the default setting for humans comes with a lot of less than ideal operating instructions. For starters, we're wired to respond to immediate threats and opportunities. Same as any other organism. Our next meal is far more important to us than the year 2030. An immediate worry will dominate our thoughts and elbow aside all thoughts of distant possible catastrophe. A simple problem will probably consume our entire attention, while complex tasks will get set aside for later. Unless we can code up and trust an artificial intelligence system that can make long-term decisions for us, you know, we do that somehow, it's fair to assume that we'll continue to operate at the political and institutional levels with an attention span that lies probably somewhere between, say, a goldfish and a really bright border collie. Today and tomorrow, those are going to dominate, but 10 years out, that's kind of too far to consider, politically and institutionally. Another impediment is our egos, which feature prominently in our daily lives. I know mine does. The ego, it's a very busy device. It's enormously devoted to rationalizing our unconscious impulses, many of which pertain to breeding, surviving, and existing within social hierarchies. You know, one of the things I say is that humans are not rational creatures. We're rationalizing creatures. So we make a decision, and it's very often emotionally based, and then we'll go out of our way to pluck data to support that, which are all rationalizations for that particular behavior. The thing about the ego is, listen, the ego could be it's a tool. And just like any tool, it could be misapplied, right? Hammer, great tool for a nail. Not so good for fixing broken china, right? The ego as a tool, left to its own devices, though, it's always in a state of want or wanting. It's always on a quest for more, which is an explanation for why you find multi-billionaires still striving to build their already unspendable wealth even further. It's why achieving success is rarely satisfying for most people. There's always another layer of success just a little bit further along that path. Now, we like to think of ourselves as rational, I've said. It's truer to say that we seek to optimize our feelings, which are regulated by chemical messengers such as dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, various neurotrophic cascades. And these various chemical processes we've got that regulate our feelings are successfully and increasingly hijacked by video game and social media companies to sell us everything from simple gadgets to complete political beliefs. And it's also true that many choices are dictated by our genetics. For example, our taste preferences are a matter of genetics and are routinely hijacked by food companies to sell us tasty, sugary, carbohydrate, and fat-rich metabolic disasters. And if you doubt this and think your taste preferences are a matter of free will, try force-feeding a Twinkie to a cat whose genetics dictate very different taste preferences from yours. And just be sure to have Band-Aids at the ready, because cats also have some amazing self-preservation hardware and a really robust software system installed to prevent them from eating Twinkies. Our biology causes us to want to eat, reproduce, pass on our genetics. What constitutes success for humans is, listen, it's the same as for any other species. We're just vastly more capable of using our big brains and social scripts to get a lot more done than other species. Success, in biological terms, means securing plenty of abundance for yourself and passing on your genes, right? So if we look at it that way, we've secured more than is essential for ourselves. You know, humans and the animals we eat are now 95% of the weight of animals on the surface of the planet. That's just remarkable. 100 years ago, completely not the case. You know, the question I'm asking here is, are we too clever by half in this story? Yeah, we are. If it means we can figure out, say, how to drill 20,000 feet underground to get at a source rock shale oil so that it can be sold at a profit tomorrow, but we can't plan for how to fuel and feed a complex economic super system of 9 billion people in 30 years when those last oily dregs are winding down. In this story, a failure to plan is the same as planning to fail. That's the trajectory we're on. This is such an easy story to tell. As I often say in public settings or in seminars, I will talk about my youngest daughter, Grace, who was born in the year 2000. So if she lives to be the same age as my grandfather, she will die in the year 2096, because he lived to be 96. So think about 2096. I mean, that's so far away, but when I think about it in terms of a single generation, it's possible that one of my children will still be alive out there sometime in the year 2096. So how can we, given that this is just, you know, within people born to recently today will easily be alive. Many people born today in this year will be alive out in the year 2100, right? So think about all the things that are past peak, guaranteed, no question about it, or completely ecologically ruined by 2100. Right. So in this story, what we're not talking about, oh, Chris, you know, trying to plan for the year 2100. Who can do that? You know, history is so complex and so many things change. But the truth is that if you were born back in, say, ancient Greek times, you might have learned a version of math that was consistent and solid and taught for 1,000 years. And, an enormous period of stability in what people knew and how we organized ourselves around that knowledge. That's what's possible and what's probable under a situation where we don't have endless gobs of tasty energy flowing out of the ground, oil in this case, fossil fuels, right? We have the equivalent of, if you took all the fossil fuels and said, what's the human energy equivalent? Like, how many humans would you need to have on bicycles spinning their little legs away to create the same amount of energy that we pull out of the ground on a yearly basis right now in terms of fossil fuels? And the answer is you'd need 500 billion energy slaves. So with about 7.8 billion people on the planet, we have the equivalent of 500 billion people of slaves equivalents running around doing stuff for us. And we say, oh, that's just how it is. That's just how it's always going to be. No, it's not. This is a once in a species bequeathment. We can do anything we want with all of this oil and fossil fuel energy. And what are we doing with it? Well, we're growing. That's what we're just defaulting into growth. We're just defaulting into securing more than we could possibly need for ourselves. And the people who are coming tomorrow, screw them, right? That's the particular model we're running. And what I'm getting at in this article, in this piece, in this report, is that story is a default story, and it's a genetic story, and it's a biological story, and it's not clever, and it's not amazing, and it's not super special. It's not a lot different from what any other organism would do, be it algae or yeast or foxes or whatever it is that we're talking about that comes across a really tasty, overly abundant supply of food, energy. Well, it's going to eat into it and beyond it. And just as a yeast, I think, fails to plan for the end of of the sugar in the vat, and that becomes the same as planning to fail. That's where we are in the story. That's really what I'm trying to expose here. Now look, we still have chances in this story to turn it around, but first, we have to be really very clear about the many hurdles and predicaments we face. We have to be alert to the idea that we have these unconscious scripts running that are actually calling the shots. Some of them, hey, those were buttons installed by our families and our culture, but the rest were installed and battle-tested by billions of years of evolutionary trial and error. And right now, the choices being made at the national and global levels are too short-sighted to succeed at anything other than maximizing short-term, well, everything. Profits, throughput, and energy dissipation all maxed out while the various environmental costs pile up. Our biology seems to be our destiny in this story, but it doesn't have to be this way. So this is where this story gets really fascinating for me. Now I'm going to talk about using the best tools that we have. You know, if you go in to visit a doctor or a psychologist, somebody who's been practicing for decades, they seem to know a lot. They do know a lot. But one of the things they may not know, depending on the field they're in, is what the latest advancements and advances are. Further, there are issues pertaining to litigation and licensing and regulatory oversight that may prevent them, actually, from availing themselves of certain new treatment modalities because they involve things that are considered illegal or unethical, such as touching somebody, right? Like you put your hand on the arm of somebody in a therapeutic setting, that may well be, you know, thoroughly illegal, even though human touch is a critical component of healing in many cases. Okay, so the question then becomes, why did we take this really brief tour, and it was brief, through the basics of our biological wiring and psychological tendencies? Well, for starters, if we're going to have any chance at all in turning this story around, we've absolutely got to accurately diagnose the root of the problems. More urgently, preparing ourselves individually for the coming crash, the eventual failure of this story, it's a really big project, and the necessary dedication rests upon accurately assessing our chances for success or failure. Maybe a good analogy is betting on horse racing. You know, for those with a solid understanding of each horse and how that horse or horses will behave in the conditions of field for a particular race, and a really good command of probability, the odds improve dramatically for structuring a winning bet. But for everybody else, without the ability to weigh the odds or assess the situation, losing money is the most likely outcome of placing a bet. So let's put on our horse racing expertise. Let's look at the human race. Let's understand what the conditions are afield right now and then make our best bets. Maybe closest to home in this story and of personal importance for any of us to make the most of our lives and to achieve real significance, shining as bright a light as we can bear, and it is uncomfortable, shining as bright a light as we can bear on our unconscious motives and drivers is essential. Knowing what makes us tick, now that's a mark of real maturity, especially if you can manage that. Those responses and what makes you tick. To move beyond success and into significance in our lives, well, that's an inward process, one that exposes our most vulnerable and protected parts to the bright light of self-inquiry. For myself, I've found that moving into greater significance in my life is not about gaining anything. It's not about learning any new skills. It's about removing old beliefs and facades, masks, scales that stand between me and the world, between me and you. There's a quote by Gandhi who's expressing a lot of the similar ideas to Jung's quote that I started this whole piece with, that if you've come to any of our seminars, of course, you've heard this. I really like this, very pithy. Captures, I think, the process beautifully. Gandhi wrote, "Your beliefs become your thoughts. Your thoughts become your words. Your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your values. Your values become your destiny." So he takes us there on a tour from how the beliefs you hold ultimately become your destiny. And I love that saying. It captures so much. It's just a few lines. It's just some brilliant phrasing in the way it's put together. But I'm now tempted to maybe add three additional lines at the beginning of this whole thing, before that line that reads, your beliefs become your thoughts. These three lines that might read, your genes create your senses. Your senses become your feelings. Your feelings inform your beliefs. And on we would go. Because it turns out that our biology is part of this story too. And that the beliefs we hold are in many ways biologically driven, biologically determined. Not entirely, but there's a component in there. And that's the part I wanted to add in this particular piece of exploration we're undergoing here. Now, the great news. What's the good news? Hey, we've learned how to hack our feelings to alter our thought processes at the level of beliefs. I'm currently reading a book on neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, called Transformational NLP by Carl Buchheit, that is shedding a lot of light for me on how we create and maintain our experience of ourselves in the larger world. Most importantly, the book reveals that the feelings and meanings we carry that might seem fixed and immutable, they're actually adjustable and far easier to hack than most suspect. And this book, I love it because at first it takes a careful tour through the history of NLP, shows you all the ins and the outs, and you know there've been some false starts. It's a whole new field, and of course there were some real stars in there, you know, a few hacks and a couple charlatans. But I love getting that grounding in the history of it. I don't think there's another one out there that I'm aware of. So the book does that, but it also begins by setting the biological stage too for all of this, which I appreciate just immensely, because that's the synthesis that we require here, the psychology and the biology. Get those together. So an example from the book, quote, most neuroscientists agree that as a product of the evolutionary process, we humans all have more than one brain, and each of our brains has a different set of instructions and descriptions about what well-being is. In his seminal work, The Triune Brain, from 1990, neuroscientist Paul MacLean writes that that nature builds new brain components and functions on top of, rather than in place of, whatever has already evolved over eons of time. And as a result, humans have goals and indicators for success. While the different brains are not completely autonomous and they each get information from the others, they can nevertheless operate somewhat independently. As MacLean describes, and this is a quote within a quote, a comparison of the brains of existing vertebrates together with an examination of the fossil record indicates that the human forebrain has evolved and expanded to its great size while retaining the features of three basic evolutionary formations that reflect an ancestral relationship to reptiles, early mammals, and recent mammals. Radically different in chemistry and structure, and in an evolutionary sense, countless generations apart. The three neural assemblies constitute a hierarchy of three brains in one, a triune brain. Based on these features alone, it might be surmised that psychological and behavioral functions depend on the interplay of three quite different mentalities. The three evolutionary formations might be imagined as three interconnected biological computers, with each having its own special intelligence, its own subjectivity, its own sense of time and space, and its own memory, motor, and other functions. End quote. End both quotes. So now, instead of thinking we have a brain, singular, we can expand to the more complete knowledge that we have multiple brains, each stacked on top of the prior evolutionary pinnacle. And they're kind of wired together. Evolution said, you know what, we're not just going to throw this whole thing out and start over. We're going to take that core operating system, and then we're going to build around that and add on top of that. So I'm sure you can understand that such a system, from a design standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to preserve the evolutionary gains, but also it's going to create difficulties getting the code, the hardware, the software to interact in such a way. So very complex, but it begins to strip away this notion that we just have a brain. Just like it was very important for me to learn early in my inner processing and journeying that I am not an individual. I'm a collection of parts from my past. I've got Chris, the little boy, the five-year-old, the three-year-old. I've got the 13-year-old. I've got all these parts in there. I've got the part, I've got a judge, I've got a critic, I've got, a higher self. All of these things exist within me. And knowing that was actually quite liberating. And similarly, learning that we have these independent brains is really just fascinating to me. And so I was reading this book and right about this, I'm probably, halfway through it. And this part was at the front. And Dave Fairtex had a recent comment on the site, and he's parallel just finding stuff and putting it up there. So our brains are in kind of lock sync around this. Very interesting synchronicity here. But be sure to catch his recent comment about the role of the lobster brain in driving certain behaviors. It's spot on to this conversation. Here's a quote from Dave Fairtex's comment. Quote, Jordan Peterson talks a lot about lobsters and how they have a keen sense of their place in the lobster hierarchy. He suggests we share this sense because antidepressants work on both humans and lobsters in kind of the same way, which he believes indicates that we share the same basic structure. And that since this commonality with lobsters dates back 300 million years when our DNA diverged from theirs, our built-in awarenesses of our place in our human hierarchy is a very, very old part of the human brain. Presumably, being the top lobster is a reproductive advantage, and being motivated to move to the top of your local lobster hierarchy therefore helps you pass along a copy of your genes. That's why this ancient biological reward structure exists and has remained in place for so very long. If you get away with doing crazy, depraved things with impunity, parens, the Emperor Caligula comes to mind, making his horse consul, his wild parties, etc., end parens, it demonstrates to your brain that you really are the top lobster, and that activates the ancient part of the brain's reward center that has been in place for 300 million years. So any group wanting to control our leadership, our leaders probably having a much more strongly developed top lobster reward center than the rest of us, almost by definition, would search for something crazy that would inject some very intense reward to that ancient bit of top lobster hierarchy sensor. Being able to get away with some really crazy things probably does an incredibly good job of triggering that reward system in these specific kinds of people. And it helps if the potential targets have low empathy too. End quote. So I love that. I love that phrasing in the quote, the idea of top lobster, and it illustrates this several ideas. One, multiple brains, some really old, archaic, relic brain structures that very long, hundreds of millions of years ago, evolution said, let's keep that. And one of those things is if it confers some advantage, if there's a thing that allows you to become top of your hierarchy, right? In this case, we're talking about lobsters. But if you watch any of the Netflix has a lot of really great nature programs, all narrated by the brilliant David Attenborough, just a fantastic job narrating. And you look through the hunters or, the land mammals or any of the sequence that are about how animals, any organism goes about surviving, thriving, reproducing. You'll find that, within the pool of water, there's a clear hierarchy. There's a top hippopotamus, a male. Same thing for walruses on the beach. Same thing for any of these social animals. They all basically, you watch them and you realize they're running a script that doesn't look any different from a male human needing another $1 billion or doing whatever it takes to secure, that next deal through banking or whatever they have to do, including cutting down whole forests, whatever they have to do, because it confers an evolutionary advantage where they're going to have better reproductive fitness. They're doing this not because it's good, right, moral, necessary, important, any of that. They're doing it because it helps them deepen their brain, get a reward that says, hey, I think you got a better chance of passing your genes on, big guy, right? That's really, what's happening here. So if we're going to shift our collective destiny in this story, if we're going to do that, we first have to shift our own personal destiny. And that means being aware of the true complexity of the brain and other systems involved, and then using the best and most powerful tools and techniques we can bring to bear. Now, modern NLP, to differentiate from the somewhat superficial versions that maybe Tony Robbins and others popularized, is a broad collection of such tools that has figured out how to rapidly repattern existing thought processes at what appears to be the belief level. Reprogram those and you literally change your destiny, right? If you can somehow change your experience in the world, if you can shift your belief system, that impacts your own destiny. And the good news, really good news, is now that we have really a lot more complete understanding of the many evolutionary components within our brains and how to most effectively rewire them into new patterns and behaviors. So yeah, understanding that biology, the wiring, that's important. And then understanding the nurture part, I've talked about this before as well. And I'm really taken by the understandings, the synthesis understandings we now have, particularly around the neuroaffective relationship model, which I've discussed before. Our own Susie Gruber is a therapist in that. It's a fantastic synthesis pulling from somatic experiencing, core energetics, neuroendocrinology, all kinds of fields to come up with this synthesized view that says, as an organism, you come out wired, you got your biology, all that, but now you have the overlays on top of that, that many people experience different forms of trauma as just a normal, almost unavoidable part of becoming a modern socialized person in this culture, right? A lot of pieces of yourself have to be put away. We do things to ourselves and to our young babies that are ultimately very traumatic, and there's ways to work through those later in life, diagnose them, work through them. It's just astonishing to see how well and how quickly these models can really help people put aside their old childhood traumas, these things that are now running their lives, the childhood trauma that might come forward and manifest as an adult into sayings like, I'm just nervous. I don't do well at parties. I have trouble focusing for long periods of time. I'm not good at math. I can't keep a clean house. Whatever the things are that are rattling around, in many cases, they have a genesis in some unresolved trauma of the past, some unconscious scripts that are back there running. That, guess what? People who are capable and competent can peer into that, and now we have the understanding of what's happening in terms of the sympathetic nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system, and how the young organism that you were as a child might have interpreted these events as actual threats to your survival. And because they were threats to your survival, activated really old parts of your wiring, one of your triune brains and probably the other brain, which is the 3 pound of neurons that are, for whatever reason, parked down in your gut. We don't know what they're all doing there yet. I have some theories, but those get activated. They go into an advanced state of alert or endangered response, right? Sympathetic nervous system response. Woo, the adrenals are firing. Heart rate's a little elevated. You have what you would call butterflies or shallow breathing, sort of vasoconstriction, all those sorts of things. Those get turned on and then they don't get detuned. They don't get turned off again. And people carry that level of survival, I'm about to die, on some lizard brain level. They're carrying that experience deeper into life because they didn't know how to untune it, detune it, turn it off again. And, you know, my personal theory around this is that, you know, human babies are, they come out and, you know, they're useless, completely useless compared to the foal that can walk within minutes, compared to the young springbok that's actually running and leaping within hours. You know, all these other animals come out ready to feed and evade danger, feed themselves, evade danger, all that stuff, right? So human babies require a really long period of time where you are completely dependent on your caregiver. So the one thing that babies come out perfectly wired to do, ready to do right from the get-go, is to get their primary caregiver to bond with them, right? So they smile and they connect. These are wired instructions that help that baby connect, because the last thing you want as a baby, evolutionarily speaking, a human baby, is for if times get tight, if times get tough, you know, the moms or dad or both are running away from a predator, or the food's really tight, you don't want to just be sort of jettisoned and left on the side of the trail, right? You want to form a really strong bond. So anything that threatens that baby's ability to perceive that it's forming a really strong bond is a deeply threatening, it's a survival a quest. It's a matter of survival, right? And so think about what happened in my generation. I'm 56. My generation, and it's still true. You can still read articles about this today. I saw one just a couple months back in a Wall Street Journal talking about how you can get your baby to sleep through the night at 6 weeks, 8 weeks tops, right? And of course, it involves a period of just letting the baby cry it out. This still passes as modern sage advice. But if you flip it all around, like you know, the subtext of all that is, hey, you know what? You got a busy life. You don't want your baby controlling it. You know, wouldn't it be great if it just slept through the night as early as possible? A little point of pride. Oh, my baby was sleeping through the night at 6 weeks, you know? Oh, that you're so lucky, right? But from the baby's experience, it was probably true that they probably had to cry it out a few nights, right? So think about that from the baby's perspective, whose wiring says, don't be left by the side of the trail. That's it, because if you do, it's game over, big boy, right? Or big girl, right? So the baby's wired to not have that happen, to not be left alone somewhere. And so although, you know, in a modern house and, you know, with a nice crib and you got the best blankets, it's obviously a very safe situation. But from one of those triune brain structures, the baby has no knowledge of that. It doesn't have that context yet. It doesn't know how safe it is or how loved or how well fed it's going to be. From its perspective, crying it out through the night could be one of the more traumatic things that can happen. So it experiences that as a threat to survival. Its body gets tuned up and ramped up into a hyper alert danger state. And then it doesn't detune from that and carries that forward into life and fashions an entire egoic structure around that initial trauma. And so guess what? We know things on the nurture side, things like the neuroaffective relationship models and modern ways like Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Never Lies, talking about how the body stores and holds and retains these early memories and how those can be accessed and released. And again, not necessarily because you remembered a story. Oh, I remembered crying it through the night. I was 6 weeks old. You won't remember that. Your body will remember it. Your brain won't. So you can't get there with cognitive therapy, by which I mean talk therapy. It's not stored in your brain. It's what we call an implicit, not an explicit memory. An explicit memory is, oh yeah, July 12th, my grandmother looked at me funny and I felt bad ever since, right? An implicit memory is that a highlighted sense of danger that got installed in your body through some incident or set of incidents at a very early age and got lodged there. And there's no story to go with it because you didn't have the cortical functions and you didn't have the associative neural trees to store the memory as a thought process using words because you didn't have them yet. You didn't have language yet. What are you going to do, right? So you stored it in your body. And guess what? Nature has got really fantastic ways of remembering dangerous things and storing them, and even passing them on, as I pointed out with the epigenetic studies of humans and then also with mice, passing on those PTSD, those traumatic experiences, passing them on to offspring. That's like nature's all about survival. And so we have a lot of things that we do in our culture, the way we raise our children, that ultimately trigger survival cues and instincts in ways that we're not aware of that ultimately result in what we're now terming trauma. And trauma doesn't mean, you know, your arm's bleeding because, well, that is trauma. But I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It could be something that seems relatively minor that would probably evade notice, certainly evaded notice for the Wall Street Journal article writers about how the amazing progress we've made in learning how to get babies to cry it out earlier and more completely in their life cycle. So we often won't even notice it for what it is. At any rate, we now know what this stuff is. We now understand what trauma is. We understand the implicit versus the explicit memories. We understand the neurochemical pathways. We know what the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems are doing. We understand we've got these triune brains, mind, body, spirit. We understand how we can put these three things together and affect really rapid transitions from one reactive state into a more adult, mature, non-threatened, responsive state. So in this part, to get back on track here, because I went off the reservation for a bit, as I am wont to do in these straight up podcasts. First things first, that's what this section's titled here. Have you ever found yourself eating even though you weren't hungry, or found yourself more angry or hostile than you should have been given the situation? Maybe you've interrupted your brain, caught it as it stewed over some past or imaginary future insult or situation while mowing the lawn or doing the dishes. Well, I certainly have. I've done all those things, and I wrote that list out because I think I've done all those things this week. These moments, when they happen, they're great moments to arrest the thought process. Just stop it. Step back. Create a little bit of distance between those unconscious impulses and those thoughts and your inner observer. And remind yourself that the evoked feelings that you have in that moment, they're not truths. And then evoke some curiosity about the actual origin of those feelings, those thoughts or sensations, whatever's going on for you, right? Just get that distance, get that inner observer just noticing. And the language might be, I see that my brain is very actively disturbed by this situation, right? I see that I'm going for food. I see there's an impulse towards food without corresponding hunger, right? Just a little noticing, just some neutral noticing. Not to say, don't put any judgments on it. It's good, it's bad, any of that stuff. So that curiosity, though, you're going to ask yourself some questions. You can say, well, where did these feelings come from, right? Are they residues from my childhood, maybe? Is my lobster brain running the ship right now? Is there something in the air that I'm responding to on a deep evolutionary brain level? The first thing, often prompted by many spiritual or meditative practices, is to create that little bit of space between one's observer self and one's thoughts, reactions, feelings. That little bit of space can make all the difference and allow new responses and insights to take root. My personal model of change, inner change, personal change, involves activating three things simultaneously: the mind, the body, and spirit. Or for spirit, chi, prana, energy, life force, God, whatever language you prefer. Right? Mind, body, and spirit. The mind, that's the map. That involves learning through change through insight and having a mental map of sort. It involves all the sorts of books, the learnings, the insights, for example, that I've serviced here in this piece, many others. I have dozens of reference materials and various teachers I draw upon to continue developing, exploring, testing, and revising what I know. And having this map is really essential to me, but it's far from being in any way a complete solution or answer. It's all just ideas until it goes into practice. Unfortunately, I notice that a lot of what passes for therapy, it's entirely in the mind. Listen, it can work, but the odds aren't really all that good. I'm saying let's use the best that we know. And so just having the mind involved is it's necessary but insufficient for me, right? The body, now that's where most of my formative experiences are stored, probably you too. And the fastest route to knowing what my lizard brains, my triune brains are up to in modifying their scripts is through the body. And being able to be with uncomfortable sensations in my body has been life-changing. So when they arise, I'm just going to notice them. I'm not there to try and make them larger. I'm not there to try and make them smaller. I'm not going to put anything around those feelings in my body. Like, oh, I'm going to experience these feelings right now so that ... I can change, I can learn something, nothing. When I say be with, it's literally giving myself the expanded ability to have the sensations, full stop. And every time I do that, I open up a little bit wider to have more of those experiences. And the thing that I've learned about the body sensations is my typical instinct in life had been to crush them back down, to deny them, to not even allow them to come up in the first place, to channel them through really careful, well-worn routes like anger or something, outbursts, projecting, blame, all those things, right? Those sort of negative channels that culturally are kind of the ones allowed for men in my culture to come forward. So just being with them and allowing them to go and exist there. We now know that there are people are starting to understand like a really important way that humans, in a really quick way, that humans can get rid of old traumas is to allow their bodies to take over and to begin to shake. And you know this if you've ever like been, pulled over by the police and you feel that body shake starting, or you've been in an accident and the shakes start a little later, or some near miss real threat, the shaking. Shaking is a normal thing. Well, now there's therapy modes where people go into rooms, I guess in California mostly, and they'll lie down with other people and they'll start their bodies shaking. And they might like read books or talk to their neighbors, and they're all lying there and they're just shaking, right? So shake therapy is a thing. And that's just something I know, which is an example of it. I know that it works, and it's an example of how you allow your body to do what it's going to do. Guess what? It knows how to get rid of the traumas of the past. It already knows how to heal itself. What? You thought your body could just like magically heal a cut in your skin? That it could magically deal with a wide variety of chemical and toxicological insults and heal all of those, but it would lack the ability to move past trauma without some board-certified PhD pill prescribing, $200 an hour expert involved? No. Your body knows how to heal itself. You just have to let it do that. And so that when I say mind, body, spirit, I'm talking about allowing the body to do what it already knows how to do. The most mostly that means getting out of its way. So if it wants to shake, just let it do that, right? And don't try and contain or control that. Just observe it. And then the final piece, the third leg in the stool, is being able to direct the energy in my body so that it flows. It's no longer stuck. And that's the final key for making rapid progress. If you get the mind, body, spirit, or energy all flowing and directed at one time, I have personally changed and witnessed other people changing just like that. Things that they've held on to for decades, parts of themselves that were immutable, just up and evaporating out of their lives and completely changing. It's the closest thing to magic that I can see. And I'm unsure what to call my practice that I've got. It's not dissimilar from, say, Tai Chi or Reiki, but it's just something I came across and developed on my own. And I notice its similarity to other things that are out there, but I haven't had the time yet to go out and really study these other things on my own yet. I mean, I've read books, but I have not made it a big study yet. So I'm really looking forward to deepening this portion, this third leg, over time with guided training at some point when I get some more free time. Now, and again, when I put my mind, my body, the energy practices into one spot, voila, I notice really rapid shifts in my experiences of life. The bottom line for me right now, I got to be honest, I'm extremely happy and content these days. Even, as you can sometimes detect in my writing, I'm sometimes angry and infuriated at what's going on or what's not going on that should be, as I judge it in today's world. I can be both evolved and evolving, happy and content, and sometimes messy and operating from my lowest brain stems or lowest triune brain organization. The difference is that I now know all those things, even as they're happening, and I know how to move myself into a new state consciously. So this isn't a one and done. I'm not saying, I'm going to evolve into some, and the goal for anybody you listening would be to evolve into some, Zen master who's unflappable under every circumstance. It'd be, great, but it's not necessarily the goal. The goal is to be and welcome all those parts of ourselves, the messy human, the careful and flappable evolved higher self. All of those things are still true and should be existing peacefully with each other. Excuse me. So the conclusion here. Well, first, thank you for listening all the way through. I know there's a lot of material in these two pieces, and honestly, I left out a lot. I brought a little bit more of it into this podcast version, the oral version here. But really there's many years of thinking, reading, personal learning that all lies beneath this particular piece of writing and inquiry. This line of inquiry also explains why I am not terribly hopeful that humans will fly to Mars or otherwise save ourselves by some super clever means, and by that, I mean, fly to Mars, that for me, that's shorthand for what I think is a fairly incomplete, childish view, which is humans will be saved if we can get ourselves to Mars. Like, and you carry that line of thinking, the implication is, well, if we wreck the Earth, at least we will have an outpost on another planet. Like, come on, people. If you can't take the most brilliant, safe, forgiving spaceship that was ever designed, and that would be the spaceship Earth, and you think that you're going to jury rig up a human contraption and put a few of these clever apes on it and launch it off to an inhospitable, cold, low pressure planet without any flowing water, and somehow that's going to represent the salvation, you're deluding yourself. So I said that explains why I'm not terribly hopeful that humans are going to fly to Mars, right? Or save ourselves by other means. And actually, that's not quite accurate. To be more clear, I have zero hope that we're going to save ourselves by being super clever and flying to Mars. Technology, it can't save us from our unexamined and misunderstood instincts and reactivity. As long as we're running these ancient primordial survival routines and remain unaware culturally of those scripts, we're going to continue to get the same outcomes as before. If we go to Mars, hey, that'll be cool, but I won't be too surprised if sexual tension and jealousy ruin that whole experiment, right? The change we wish to see in the world, it begins with us as individuals. To me, it makes zero sense to advocate for any political or collective solution if the root causes have not yet been identified. The same critique I would have if, say, a doctor began administering medicines and treatments before carefully examining a patient. I mean, what difference is it going to make if we elect new people who will simply run the old scripts while applying defunct narratives? Right? It's not going to make no difference at all. Instead, I believe our salvation, if it's to come, will be found by going more deeply inwards, only by resolving our inner traumas that may well not even be ours. If they come to us generationally from traumatized direct relatives, can we begin to operate from a place of wholeness? To think, act, and plan for long-term horizons, we have to be able to understand our basic biology and how it interacts with the world around us so that we can set that aside if and when necessary. All of which is why it bothers me so much to see politicians and central bankers, you know, they're just working so hard to keep business as usual operating at 100% capacity. Like, they don't even allow, it's not even 99%. Like, we'll set 1% aside for the most thoughtful scientists and spiritual leaders and individuals who could possibly navigate a different course for us, because, you know, we'll put 1% aside for the idea that maybe we have to head in a different direction besides just endlessly growing and putting as many humans on the planet as possible, right? Now, we're dedicating 100% to business as usual right now. And so that's why I consider the efforts of literally virtually every politician and central banker today, no matter how kind they may be, their efforts are actually working against true progress in this story. Well, you know what? Oh, well, I can't do too much about that. So what we do know, though, is there's a huge, exciting, emerging body of knowledge at our fingertips. We can, if we choose, completely change ourselves, even freeing ourselves from the clutches of evolutionary forces that were perfectly suited, say, to 35,000 years ago, but are now actually working against our best interests here in 2019. Are we as a species headed towards greatness or oblivion? Are we going to achieve our highest significance that we're capable of, or extinction? Well, that remains an open question. And that's the good news. I do believe that actually remains an open question. It's not settled yet. The answer really depends, though. The answer on which of those outcomes we get really depends on whether we can understand and then master our unconscious selves enough to really change the dynamics in time. In other words, before we render this glorious, forgiving spaceship uninhabitable for ourselves. The Earth, it's going to be just fine. Humans, that's the open question. I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation with you, and Adam and I have been working hard on a new offering for engaging in a deep and meaningful way with Peak Prosperity readers for whom this material resonates strongly. And that, if that includes you, stay tuned. You're going to be hearing more from us about this soon. For people who want to take these and other really pressing, important questions on a more intimate and deeper journey with our tribe. So stay tuned for that. Again, thank you so much for listening. I'm Chris Martinson. I will be talking with you next time.